Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is August 22nd, 2014. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome Bruce Rawls. Bruce is an ACIM teacher and workshop facilitator with a very interesting background. In fact, I must admit, when I went to his blog and his website, I just kept getting lost in all the stories and all the information. And a lot of it was not A Course in Miracles, but I just found myself going through this maze of really wonderful things. So thank you for that, Bruce. But Bruce has been a student of the Course since 1984, but he admits that the pace significantly changed after reading Gary Renard's book, The Disappearance of the Universe, in 2007. And Bruce says that he's fueled by a love of both the mystical and the miraculous within the mundane. He's involved in multiple ACIM study groups in Colorado and Oregon. And in addition to ACIM, he's a metaphysical researcher, an artist, a presenter, and an author of Sacred Geometry Design Sourcebook. Now, I have a pretty strong hunch I need to invite him to join me on my other radio show, Simple Tales, so that we can talk about sacred geometry. But for today, we'll stick to the topic of A Course in Miracles. And specifically, Doug is going to talk about, Bruce, I don't know where I got Doug there. Bruce is going to talk about the double shield of oblivion, which is touched upon briefly in lesson 136. And that's quite the mouthful to talk about the double shield of oblivion. So I'm glad you're going to talk us through that and give us some great information about that. And everybody, while you're listening, join us in the 1-2-listen.com private group on Facebook. One of the easiest ways to get there is to go to the 1-2radio.com website. And on the left side of the page, you will see that column and there will be a word that says chat. Click that button and you'll be automatically redirected to our private group. Now, if you're not already a member, just hit the join button and come on in to the 1-2 Radio chat room. That guy at the door ready to let you in, that's our producer, Scott Weaver. Thanks for being here today, Scott. And thank you, Bruce. Welcome.
Well, thank you, CA. It's a pleasure and privilege to be on your show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm so looking forward to it because, like I said, when I got to your website, I thought, oh my gosh, we've got to talk about sacred geometry. But that is not the topic for today. So truly, you're going to have to come back and talk on my other show, which is on Tuesdays, because I'd love to hear more about the sacred geometry. So
I'd be happy to do that, of course.
Okay. Why don't we just start off really briefly with, do you want to describe a little bit about yourself and how you got into a course?
Sure. What happened was, ever since I can remember, really, I always kind of kept thinking there must be something different going on. Yeah, it must be kind of like the classic ACIM line that started, Helen and Bill's quest of, there must be a better way here. Yeah, and so in grade school and into high school, I kind of was drawn to metaphysical things. I suppose largely, I was sort of on the coattails, if you will, of my mom, who kind of got disenchanted with her typical Christian church-going stuff, and when she was, when I was basically entering adolescence, and dragged my sister and dad and I and my brother around to all these different churches where I grew up in Livermore, California, and then she explained that what fueled this was that when she was a teenager, she had an experience of seeing a fleet of UFOs on Catalina Island or something. Anyway, something, a whole bunch of things moving really fast and making an abrupt right angle turn and then disappearing at, warp whatever.
Warp speed.
and she said if it was a hallucination, it was a mass hallucination, because she said every head on the beach turned in tandem. Out of her peripheral vision, she was watching that, and everybody kind of looked at each other and then, I guess, shrugged it off, which actually kind of ties in nicely to the topic of the double shield of oblivion. But anyway, just to wrap the personal history thing up fairly quickly. So anyway, her metaphysical quest, I sort of tagged along for the ride in high school and read books like Life and Teachings of the Master of the Far East and stuff like that. I kind of was like looking for some other explanation of why the heck we were all in this crazy world together. And so I sort of did the spiritual buffet line, which I think you kind of alluded to.
Oh, yeah.
skipping from this to that to try to figure out what's the meaning here. And then I got involved in a group called Creative Dynamics and was teaching that through adult schools in Northern California, which is basically a positive thinking, a sort of a new age smorgasbord, if you will. And that was fun, and I enjoyed that. And I experienced when I was doing that I would say things, and then I'd later on say, well, where did that come from? You know, but it was that sort of recognition that there really is an inner guide or an inner teacher that we all have that really is, whose message is kindness, and that led to in this creative dynamics group. I'd moved up to the foothills of Northern California, and part of a kind of quasi intentional community, and we were studying a bunch of metaphysical things in this group, and one of them that we sort of talked about really more than anything else was when Marianne Williamson and Jerry Jampolsky were doing a lot of their early work, was this thing called A Course in Miracles. So I got the book, and like a lot of people, it sat there for a few years because I heard about it in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was really after I moved. I'd gone back to school, moved to Grass Valley, California, and I had one of these off-the-chart years where my father, uncle, grandfather, and a close friend all passed away. And I got divorced, changed where I lived, changed where I work, one of those, on the surface, big deal years, right? And so I thought, well, maybe there's something, I was kind of drawn to pick up this blue book, or actually it was three books at the time. And so I started reading the text and going to study groups there. And I found deep solace in there. But I didn't really quite, get a lot of the ideas in a course. I think I was reading really more like Ken Wapnick says, great work of poetry. Uh-huh. Because I kind of let the feeling behind it wash over me. And then it wasn't until years later, after doing, again, the spiritual, metaphysical smorgasbord, buffet line kind of thing, that I, a buddy of mine who some of you listeners might know, aka Giddyup Mikey Lemieux, bumped into each other in the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library after my wife and I had moved to Southern Oregon. And he looked over my shoulder on this kiosk, and I was looking up A Course in Miracles. He said, "Oh yeah, it was The Disappearance of the Universe." And because I just basically had been house sitting for a friend for a week because I was commuting back and forth from a place in where I lived in Southern Oregon in Eagle Point to Ashland at the time, and then on this friend's coffee table was these two books. One of them was, and they were by an author by this Gary Renard person. I'd just seen this Living Luminaries documentary in a local theater in Ashland there. And I thought, gee, I'd actually had interviewed Don Miguel Ruiz, and I'd met Marianne Williamson and Neil Donald Walsh, and I'd read Eckhart Tolle and knew some of the people in that film. But this Gary Renard was just like, who was this guy? And then here, I thought, I like what he had to say, and here's his two books. And I was planning to work on my second book. And I during this house sitting episode, a week and a half, which I was basically saving a little commute time by doing this. So I thought, I'll get focused on writing the second book. Well, it totally changed what I put in the second book because it totally got me back into the course. Uh-huh. And there were things in there like that God had nothing to do with the universe. It's like, oh, I know that was in there, but how did I miss that?
It's a big one.
It is. How did I gloss over that? And another thing that I kind of, glazed over, which again ties into our topic for today of the mindlessness and the shield of oblivion. Another idea in that whole series of books that Gary's now written that I somehow missed was that forgiveness was like the pivotal concept of the practice of how to undo this whole ego thing. And so I through Gary and his writing and his teachers, I got hurled back into a course back in 2007. and then got involved in a bunch of study groups in Southern Oregon, and then when we moved to here to just south of Denver about 3 years ago, found local groups here, and then really got back into studying Ken Wapnick's work big time.
Nice.
And so I just saturate myself with that.
Yes. Well, good, because that's what we do on this show. We're kind of a Ken Wapnick, you know, fan club here.
Yeah. Well, hooray, hooray. I mean, I never did get to meet Ken, but I finally got out to the Temecula Center last May and just spent a Wednesday there and went to a couple of sessions and totally enjoyed it. And but you know, at the same time that I had this sort of, you know, sort of semi melancholy of like, oh, I wish I had met Ken. And then whenever that thought arises, I almost can hear his voice saying, "Hey, I'm still here. Nobody left. You know, nobody was here to leave," kind of thing.
That's right. That's nice. Well, and I feel very fortunate. I got to meet him once. Uh-huh. I took a work. He came to Denver a few years ago, I did a workshop with him. And uh-huh. I'll tell you, I'm so glad I did, because reading his stuff before, I really struggled with it. But uh-huh. once I heard him speak and sort of, I'd say, got his personality, uh-huh. all of a sudden, I just loved his materials and could really read his materials and understand them and even laugh through them. And I don't know what it was. Just meeting him in person did that. But I think it also happens when you just listen to him as well. So
it does. Yeah. And because I had Forgiveness in Jesus on my bookshelf, uh-huh. one of the original editions, for many years, and I realized that my resistance to open well, I'd read a few pages, but I set it down, and I think that's where the resistance is, again, ties into this topic so wonderfully, because, you know, we are only going to do what we're ready to do when we're ready to do it. And that gets back to the free will principle that, you know, I think Gene Roddenberry captured so nicely in the Star Trek Prime Directive, that, you know, if we try to interfere with anyone else's path, we're basically, you know, discounting, as the Course says, the law of cause and effect, the most fundamental law there is. And so, you know, we're basically saying, no, I don't trust the process. I think I need to change something outside myself. And you know, we all do it at times, but it's kind of fun to catch yourself and watch that process.
Yes.
Yeah.
So tell us about this oblivion, the double shield of oblivion.
Yeah.
And what a phrase, huh?
It really is. Yeah. It there's only one place, from what I understand, that it's mentioned in the course. It's in the middle of paragraph 5 in lesson 136. I'll just read it.
Okay.
And it goes, "It is this quick forgetting of the part you play in making your, quote, reality, unquote." Already putting a little humor in there. "That makes defenses seem to be beyond your own control. But what you have forgot can be remembered, given willingness to reconsider the decision, which is doubly shielded by oblivion." And then the paragraph concludes with, "Your not remembering is but the sign that this decision still remains in force, as far as your desires are concerned. Mistake not this for fact. Defenses must make facts unrecognizable. They aim at doing this, and it is this they do." And so really, we have these two defenses. I like to think of them, this double shield of oblivion, as like a huge moat around a castle.
Okay.
And so the physical world, the world of space and time and our bodies and all the stuff in it, is really just the outer moat that we keep stockpiled with plenty of piranhas and crocodiles and leeches and, you know, other pleasantries that pleasant things that make sure that we don't go there.
Right.
But it's like a firefighting thing. We keep so busy and in the world and doing things and thinking that we have to be identified with this persona and its poster child, the body, that we spend most of our time just dealing with the stuff that comes up and thinking that's the big deal. And mm-hmm. that's the outer shield of oblivion. The inner shield then would be the mind, of course, but particularly the ego the divided, the split mind that, that thinks that somehow, and this is where the castle is, and the big wooden door with the chains that lower it down, that is always shut as far as the ego is concerned. Because once if we somehow brave a swim across the outer shield of oblivion and get past the mindlessness of the world's defenses, if we get to that inner defense, which is the unconscious guilt, and we are willing to look at that, it's like we've penetrated that door, and we've you know somehow convinced someone to lower the door. We've climbed the the castle walls and breached that inner security, and then that's when, in either case, the alarms go off in the ego's control panel.
That's right, danger, danger.
Exactly, danger, Will Robinson. Yeah. We get. You know, we set off a 5-alarm, you know, blaze in the ego's, you know, arsenal of defenses, basically, because once we start looking at the guilt, and see it for what it is, which, as Ken reminds us so nicely, is nothing, and it is, like he says, it's not evil, it's not wicked, it's not sinful, it's just silly. That threatens the ego beyond compare, because that means that. The personal self that we've spent so much time and investment establishing and maintaining, you know, the Course tells us, the central thought the Course attempts to teach is that there is no world. And of course, the outer world of space and time and individuality is, pretty damn convincing.
Right.
I mean, it's a hologram that we have made up that is better than any special effects house could possibly do, but it's a production. It's a dramatic production, and our signature is at the bottom of each page of the screenplay. And if we're willing to admit it, you know, as much as that's what I think where victimhood comes in is you know the willingness to foist out from ourselves, thinking that ideas can leave their source and we can somehow project out and use our, as Calvin and Hobbes might say, you know, our blame thrower and you know, conveniently foist the blame, the culpa, the mea culpa, you know, that is now somehow shifted conveniently to the other, the big other out there, and that's part of that outer shield. As long as we can be enthralled by and entranced by the world's stuff and keep our projections intact. That is a safeguard against being mindful and then forgiving, because in order to forgive, there's two things that have to happen. We have to collapse space in a way, because we're basically acknowledging from that place of calm within us that there's nobody outside us. We have this incredibly vast set of actors. I mean, just 7 billion plus humans on this planet alone, not to mention all the other critters.
The aliens off the coast of Catalina.
Yeah. For example, You know, we're just let alone the flora and fauna of our little planet here. But then we also have, you know, the outer characters, but they're all really just symbolic emissaries. They're metaphors for aspects of ourselves that we've disowned and foisted out and projected out and said, "Oh, now I can you know keep the face of innocence and by making other people guilty." Another thing that Ken Wapnick says that I really like, when babies are born, you know, that we hear something like goo goo gaga, but if we could all speak baby-ese or whatever the term would be, doesn't matter the language, what every child that's born is really saying is, "It's not my fault."
Yeah. That's right. And how did I get here?
Yeah. It's just, it wasn't my doing, you know, but that's part of this mindlessness that is the key, the linchpin. It's the key thing in the ego strategy. As long as we can, you know, stay mindless and be identified with being this persona that has this little poster child body, and think that that's it, that's ourself, then that keeps us from looking inside the castle and seeing there's nothing there.
Yeah.
there's, you know, all the guilt that we thought was going to be this horrific dungeon is just this empty thing. Yeah, in fact, it reminds me, years ago I had this really neat dream that was really kind of shook me in a cool way. I dreamt that I was in this empty theater, and all I could hear is just kind of the quiet hiss of the air conditioning. but even that was kind of like made up, you know. But it was like there was this huge screen and all this seating, but there was nobody there. And I remember I actually hopped out of a large window that was in the projection booth. And then I hopped back in and realized that, you know, it was already over. And I thought, wow, this is like the tiny mad idea. And years later, when I, you know, got back into the course and thought about it, it was like, well, this is like a perfect metaphor for this tiny mad idea that says we could possibly have split perfect oneness. Mm-hmm. And then we blame ourselves and beat ourselves up in countless ways for that alleged infraction. But it's like a theater that we've we currently think that there's all this stuff going on, you know, this massive hologram of space and time and all the stuff that we need to do and want to do. And, you know, like just an hour ago, I was getting blood drawn for an annual physical. And then early this week, I was calling a tow truck to arrange for our car that its transmission went out to be towed back to our house where we're getting ready to sell it. And I applied for a job yesterday. So all this stuff is like, oh man, I've got all these things I need to do, you know?
And it's never ending.
It's never ending. So I don't think and I really like what Ken says, you know, it's like the ego is always 100% insane. Uh-huh. And our inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. Holy Spirit, a.k.a. Jesus of the Course, not the Jesus of the Bible necessarily, but you know, that symbolic emissary of that way to return from the dream is always reminding us that we can go home at any time. And that part is 100% sane. So we have this 100% insane thought system, a.k.a. ego, this default mode of silliness that tells us that we're separate from each other. And then we have this 100% sane thought system of, or I like inner kindness teacher as a just a placeholder name, that says, not to worry. just look at this craziness with me. And that really is addressing the decision maker, which is the third part of that whole system that Ken talks about, is Ken Wapping, that we constantly have the choice to decide, and moment to moment. In fact, there is a lady named Robin McWane who gave a talk to a group that my wife and I started called New Frontiers of the Gold Country in Northern California years ago, and she'd been studying modern physics and gave an evening presentation, and she rattled off a statistic that I later looked up and found it was what's called the Planck time constant. And Planck was one of the physicists back in the, you know, several decades ago when the quantum theory was being developed. His name is all through that literature. Anyway, he came up with a space constant and a time constant. And the space constant is a super little tiny thing. I think it's like 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, something like that. And the time constant is equally tiny. It's like 10 to the minus 44th seconds. So if you were to divide a second of our imaginary time into, you know, 10 to the 44th pieces, according to what she was saying at this evening talk, that our universe literally winks out and then comes back again full blown as a dream 10 to the 44th times per second. So that's a huge stroboscopic hologram, basically.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
but each moment we are, you know, choosing to bring back in either one of those two thought systems, that 100% insane one or the 100% sane one. So one of the ideas I think that Ken Wapnick shares that I find really helpful is that we don't ever get rid of the ego, but what we do is we slowly change the amount of time that we identify with the ego. So that over time, you know, these little 10 to the 44th second slivers, not that we probably are conscious of that, but those, all those little slivers of time, when we start steering them in terms of our interpretation over to the Holy Spirit's interpretation, our inner kindness teacher's interpretation, then we start feeling more peaceful. And mm-hmm. I think that's the immediate payoff that Gary Renard and his teachers talk about as well, that, you know, when we practice this quantum forgiveness, we find that we can actually enjoy the dream while we recognize it's a dream, and then undo it at the same time, mm-hmm. which is the long-term benefit of it all.
Yeah, and you just touched upon something that I think is really important, which is, and maybe this is just me, but I'd like to think that I can just flip a switch and it's done. You know, like, okay, did it. You know, right. I got it. I did the course. I got it. I'm done. And exactly. It doesn't work that way. We don't ever get rid of the ego. We right. just quit listening to its voice. And in some ways, that's frustrating because you want to think, God, I thought I had this. I thought I had this, you know? I mean, and really, this situation is coming back around again, you know?
Uh-huh,
and,
uh-huh.
And that is frustrating. But it that is the thing, is to remember that we always are the decision maker. Exactly. We're always making the choice, and we just keep making the right choice, so to speak. You know, go for the right mind, go for the right teacher, because I think we do want to think we can just flip a switch.
Yeah.
You know, and then we're done.
and I think that sort of thinking is really an important aspect of the resistance and the mindlessness that really is constitutes those shields of oblivion. Because when we think, I went to that weekend workshop, I'm done, you know,
right?
I've got it fully integrated. but fortunately, it is actually holographic in the sense that when we forgive one thing fully, as the Course suggests, you know, then we've forgiven everything. And I think there's like little arms of the tree branches, if you will, of the fractal, and that every time we really deeply release ourselves and not judge ourselves for having made up a silly dream, that releases us by that much more to the inevitable moment where we just say, okay, been there, done that, game over, and it flashes mm-hmm. across the mind screen.
Right.
But our beloved Blue Book also suggests that if Toto pulled the curtain back all at once, we'd freak out, you know. so we get a little bit at a time. We get to undo slowly at a pace that leads us away from fear rather than deeper into it. Because if we recognized how devastatingly bleak and hideous the ego strategy is all at once, and really grok that, I think we'd all run screaming, you know, and no way, you know, get out before it's too late, kind of thing. But that's really the ego's part of the ego strategy is basically, you know, it wants us to be mindless, and that's really, again, the whole idea is if we can keep blaming ourselves and judging ourselves for having chosen this, then it. You know, like the Snidely Whiplash, you know, is, yeah, I got you again. Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes that villainous, cackling laugh and smile, that really is a fake smile that says, ah, I've managed to avert the gaze. I've managed to, convince the decision maker to turn away from looking at the nothingness. You know, we've put on Gollum's ring again, and that part of us that we don't want to look at has now conveniently disappeared. You know, so we really do have that choice moment to moment to leave the dream of exile and to look at the victimhood and recognize that it's just a game that we've been playing that we can learn to laugh at gently and release our attachment and identification with, and to see how surreal, you know, this dualistic world really is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that story by J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, Gollum's Ring, you know, The Hobbit, because I sometimes think about that actually with A Course in Miracles, because, you know, the ring, this powerful ring, even the wisest people know this ring is going to get me in trouble. You know, and so it's sort of, you want it so badly because it's so powerful and it's so addictive, and yet you have to just fight with everything to know it's still, it's an illusion and it's a bad dream. It's going to send you to a bad place, no matter how great it feels at first to be powerful and to be invisible or to have, to just have all these skills and abilities and powers. And yet it's always, you have to always make the decision, I'm not going to go down that road, because once you go down the road, you're addicted to it, you know. So I love a lot of the stuff in those books reminds me of being on the path,
yeah,
you know, of A Course in Miracles.
Exactly. And that's part of what, part of the way to undo it is we can take any work, you know. Certainly it's easy when you've got something that's full of metaphors like Wizard of Oz or Lord of the Rings, or, you know, so many of the genre of the virtual reality film. Inception is a favorite film. You know, there's so many movies out there that have elements that we can go, aha, and these light bulb moments that says, oh yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm deep in a dream that's basically trying to keep me asleep, and I can wake from it whenever I choose, if I want to look at it, but I have to look at it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where our classroom is so important, that whether it's a blood test or a blown transmission or you know, scrambling to get stuff for a job application, you know, just picking three things sort of at random from the last week in my dream, you know, I can look at that and say, oh, how interesting! I've been using that and my associations and my mental connections with these experiences in the world to keep me anchored in this dream. I can look at those things and begin to, while I'm doing, you know, whatever's appropriate in the level of form, I can just start to, when I remember, to just say, oh, I don't have to take this quite so seriously. This is, you know, to pick another favorite, you know, metaphysical. These aren't the droids we're looking for. You know, this
that's right.
this isn't the identity that we want to find. You know, I mean, we really can. go beyond those mechanistic models and look at what really does make a difference. And what really does make a difference is our decision-making mind to be able to look at the grievances, to look at the victimization, to look at every least little irritation that crosses our mind and say, ah, this is something that by default ego is going to use to keep me imprisoned in the belief in separation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just that, you know, you mentioned there something really important, that whole idea, I would call it mental wandering, you know, and somewhere in the course it says, you're just so tolerant of letting your minds wander. And just the idea too, that it's easy to say, oh, well, I really need to address anger, but I don't need to address a small irritation.
Right.
And yet the course says it's all the same stuff.
Exactly.
Every single one of them is.
Right. A hangnail and a Holocaust, you know, Hiroshima and a hangnail are, you know, on the level of form, obviously very different.
Mm-hmm.
But in truth, from above the battleground, as the course would put it, from looking down from the perspective of our inner kindness teacher at the dream drama that we've made up, our tantrum yoga classroom. You know,
I like these analogies. Can you wait while I write these all down?
Oh, sure.
The dream drama, the tantrum yoga, and what was you had another one in there?
Oh, I don't know. I've got a bunch of them, but anyway.
I love it.
Yeah. But yeah, all these things are just ways to keep us mindless and to keep us, you know, chasing the carrot on the imaginary stick that says, oh, somehow I'm going to find the right combination of, you know, partners, jobs, possessions, health regimen, you know, fame, et cetera, et cetera. All the stuff that the world acknowledges is something that you should go for. and supports enthusiastically, that there's anything wrong with any of those things. I mean, it would be silly to just say, oh, I don't have to brush my teeth or you know, whatever, right. or go to work today or yada, yada. But when those become things that have the ability by our choice to disturb our peace, then the light bulb moment can go on and we can say, aha, I can be mindful of when I'm allowing X fill in the blank to take my peace away.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you then a very specific question. What do you actually do? I mean, like, for instance, do you have a little mantra that you use? Or what do you do? Like, when, for instance, all of a sudden the transmission quits working and you need to be somewhere in 30 minutes and, you know, there goes, that job interview is blown or whatever it is. What do you do right then?
You know, I don't have a set pattern, but I just try to remember to be mindful and to watch my feelings and thoughts and notice when I'm the least bit irritated. And then that's like, bingo, you know, the dashboard indicator light's going, nert, 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 alert, you know. And then I can say, oh, hey, I have an acronym that I like to use. That basically is my ego alert indicator. Mm. And actually, it's GIST for guilt, individuality, space, and time. And I think that covers a lot of ground because – ego has to use one of those four things in some fashion or another in order to get its hooks into our mind and, you know, shut it down, basically. So the space and time, I think, are two of the key things that if we can look at and see how our unforgiveness is hinged on some aspect of some special or specific thing in space, which is usually another person or a group of people or a situation in the world, you know, whatever it happens to be, those things are seen as outside of ourself. So when we collapse the space and say there's nobody and no thing outside myself, then that brings it back inside. So we're basically, you know, chiseling away at the outer shield of oblivion there by collapsing the space. If we collapse the time, then we recognize, well, eternity is the only time that makes sense in truth. It's the only reality. And so, yeah, years ago, even before I kind of got into A Course in Miracles, I kind of arrived at a working definition of truth as, you know, something that doesn't change. So I figure if anything is changeable, then how could it be true? So anything ephemeral or transitory, the bodies, you know, the planets, the whole, you know, galaxies, I mean, all that changes. So how could anything that involves matter and energy or space be true? Because if it changes, then and of course time and space are, you know, irrevocably interwoven because they're part of the ego's dream. Then if I can look at that and say, well, if I can collapse time to now, which is really the gateway to eternity, then that means that all the things that I think happened, all these experiences that I can label as bad or unsavory or unpleasant, all those things in truth never happened. So those are two, I think, foundational pieces of a quantum forgiveness that I like to practice, which is that I can give my space and time dreams over to Holy Spirit, to my inner kindness teacher, and say, okay, if I collapse those, there's nobody out there, and nobody did anything to me because nothing happened. So from that perspective, I can allow, by bringing that to mind, putting that on the altar, or bringing the darkness to the light, whatever metaphor you like, then the Holy Spirit, and then release it. But to recognize it is kind of the three R's, to reveal it, and the second step of that forgiveness process, releasing, is just like loosen that white knuckle grip on the steering wheel. Uh-huh. take those fingers one by one and gently pry them off this attachment, this, you know, aversion, whatever it is, and say, okay, I can let go of this. And then the third step, as our beloved Blue Book suggests, is we just have to get the heck out of the way. We have to, you know, move over to the passenger seat and let Holy Spirit at the controls and do the interpretation, and then that inner kindness teacher will replace our thinking, which is, you know, the individual egoic nonsense, with the "it never happened" track. And the specifics are what we need, though, in order to look at it. Because we can't go beyond the specific unless we're willing to look at the specific to see that there's nothing there. So as this is a course in not know, we have to look at the things that seem to be in order to go beyond them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, and I have a question for you, because I have a feeling that you probably have not, you know, a little quick tip, but something that would be very helpful. Something that I run into that I find people really have a difficult time with is the concept of you don't bring your inner teacher into the dream. You take
right.
your dream to the inner teacher.
Exactly.
And, you know, I feel like I'm a fairly good explainer, but I'll tell you what, that's the one I can just see people's faces glaze over like, well, what do you mean? You know, why wouldn't I ask for help with this thing? And let's face it, we're steeped in that idea of call on God, call on the angels, call on whoever, you know, come help me in this situation. And I think that's one of the, it's a habit that's really hard to break. And so what would you tell people, or how would you explain that and the importance of it and how to do it?
Well, I think just to back up a little, I think what we do when we try to bring our guidance into the dream is we're saying, okay, Holy Spirit, fix the dream. We're basically right. asking for our inner kindness teacher to don a dream repair task force outfit on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically saying, okay, we're saying, I want you to fix this thing that never happened.
Right.
But we don't never phrase it that way. We because the moment we try to bring that guidance into the dream, motivated by the will, the wanting to have the dream be better or more to our liking, we're basically saying what the Course says, I want it thus. We're basically saying, my happiness is contingent on a specific or a situation or a circumstance or an experience that has, you know, some qualities or you know, specifics that make me happy.
Right.
And that's basically the whole thing in a nutshell. That's how we keep trying to bring that awareness into the dream, because from the ego standpoint, it can, you know, utilize anything that the Course has to its advantage, because it's basically saying, I want the new age concept of fixing the dream to be where I'm going with this thing. It basically says, if I can fix the problem here in the outer shield of oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
If I can make space and time behave the way I want it to behave, then I'll be happy.
Exactly.
Which of course is reversing cause and effect. It's putting the cart before the horse instead of the heart before the horse.
Mm-hmm.
So all we need to do really is watch those things, and it's a scary thing, and that's why I think being gentle with ourselves and forgiving ourselves when we try to do that is so important, and watching our tendency to judge ourselves when we catch ourselves, and then make that a big deal of, you know, self-flagellation of, oh, you
did it again.
You're stuck in ego again there, Bruce. Okay. You know, but once we start seeing that strategy and saying, oh, I don't have to judge myself when I notice that happening, because that's all that the ego can do. I mean, it's never going to give up on that strategy and that approach. But
no, it's not.
But we can use our decision maker to choose, and to remember that this entire curriculum is talking about a mind, not a person. And that once we do make that shift, then we're bringing our problems to the altar of the mind, and saying, ah, I can bring this dark, horrific problem, whether it's a hangnail or a, you know, Holocaust, to the altar, and remember that we made it up. And, you know, but only from the perspective of that inner kindness teacher are we going to see that. Because otherwise, we're walking around in this mindless state, like the, you know, if you've seen, anybody seen the Men in Black Neuralizer, you know, where at the end, where people that aren't supposed to see what they're doing with the aliens, you know, if a crowd gathers, they just flash out this little pen that in a flash of light, and then they forget everything that happened.
Oh, I haven't seen the Men in Black.
Oh, okay. Well, for those listening who've seen the movie, they'll get it. But basically, it's this crew that's basically combating the mean aliens essentially, and whenever they see too much that would freak out and destroy the culture, and because then they'd know that there's extraterrestrials everywhere, then they flash this little pen that has a little light on it that's they call a neuralizer, and then immediately people just walk along and do whatever they were doing before they caught a glimpse of whatever the Men in Black were doing with the aliens, But that's kind of like a neat symbol that we forget about our complicitous involvement in the cause, and we play dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that our woes and our drama and our victimhood seems justified because we put the face of innocence out there, or we put the face rather on ourselves and put the guilt out there. Mm-hmm. And so as long as we're doing that, then we can justify the mindlessness.
Right. We believe our own crap. Is that what is the saying that when you put out a story and then you believe it, you turn around and say, everybody's saying it. And it's like, but
right.
You see it first.
Yeah, exactly. I saw it on TV or the web. It must be true.
That's right. But you put it out there.
Right. Yeah, I think that's another important principle, too. Again, the cause and effect principle that basically, keeping in mind that ideas don't leave their source, and that everything that, is a projection really becomes a perception. But we forget that conveniently, the inconvenient truth to paraphrase a former presidential candidate. The inconvenient truth is that we, on the chalkboard of our mind, we erased the cause to effect arrow. And then now all we have is just the feedback. We've forgotten that we set this up. We wrote the script, our signature's on the bottom of every page of our screenplay. But we don't want to look at that. We want to just look at what's coming back as a result of our mind's decision to choose the ego and say, oh, they're doing it to me.
That's right.
This is, oh, how dastardly of them, And so I find that it's really helpful when I start noticing I'm demonizing demonizers even,
Right.
Because it can be pretty subtle, You watch stuff on the evening news or Stewart and Colbert or Bill Maher, some of my favorites, to just kind of have a little comic relief from the craziness of the world. But watch it and just look at it and just say, oh, isn't it interesting how we all want to find scapegoats that reinforce these shields of oblivion?
Yes. Hey, and on that note, we do have an external control here, and that is that our hour is almost up. We have about, I know, can you believe it? We have about, well, we did get a little bit late start, but that happens. But in any case, as we close the show, we've got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
So I want to give you the opportunity to make any announcements that you would like to make about, things that you're doing, things that people in the local area may want to attend,
sure.
Where they can find you on your website, etc.
Sure. Well, thanks. And thanks again for having me. I also want to say I really have enjoyed the interviews you've done with Susan Dugan and more recently Doug Sparks, who are both friends. And which also reminds me that one of the ideas that I think is really important is that if we can be totally inclusive and remember that everyone really is not just our friend, but all of spirit, like Gary Renard's teachers have suggested,
mm-hmm.
that if we can see that everyone is fighting the same hard battle between these two thought systems. Everyone is making that decision moment to moment between the two thought systems, and that's what we have. So to share how to get a hold of me, I have a website that's acimblog.com, and on there you'll find all kinds of stuff about the course and one of the things that I'm participating in, and I actually have talked a bit about what I'm going to talk about there, is this a virtual ACIM conference that's coming up in October. And if people want to participate in that, it should be real interesting. It's 3 days, and it'll be a lot of fun. So I'm active on Facebook a lot. I have an ACIM blog page on Facebook, and I try to post something from Ken Wapnick every day on there. And just have a lot of fun, and I'd enjoy hearing from everyone.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And by the way, Greg in the chat room says that's a great name for a book, Hang Nails to Holocaust. So if you're looking for any ideas, he thinks that's a great idea.
Okay.
Greg and everybody else, thank you so much for being in the chat room today and for all the listeners. And Bruce, thank you so much. You have got to come back. And
thank
truly,
you.
I want to have you on Simple Tales, too, so that we can talk about sacred geometry.
Sure, you bet.
It would be great. And Scott, thank you for doing the producing today. And everybody, I hope you will stick with us, because coming up next is Christine DeMaurier on Fabulous Fridays on 1-2 Radio with the Through Line. So thanks for being here. And until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.
People passing by, see friends shaking hands.